Good evening, everybody. My name is Chris, and I am an alcoholic. It's a very interesting topic. I think I've probably spoken a little bit about it before, but you know, having it as a topic made me think. You know, what really has happened? I believe we're in the middle of a renaissance. I believe that there are groups springing up all over the world that are literature-based meetings, solution-based meetings that are using the book Alcoholics Anonymous as a recovery tool for experiencing the freedom from alcohol, the spiritual transformation that's inherent in working the exercises and the steps in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And so it is an interesting topic for me. You know, like the other two speakers, Scott and Jonathan, my experience showing up in the rooms of AA was an insufficient experience for me, just showing up in the fellowship. I believe very, very much in what you find in the big book. The explanations in the big book make good sense to me. They're not necessarily scientific, but they're observable. And one of the things that is observable is there's a scale in alcoholism. No matter how far down the scale we've gone, we'll find our experience can benefit others. One's ability to quit on a non-spiritual basis will depend upon the amount of control one has lost in drink. There's a lot of references to this scale in the book. If you look in the chapter to wives, it's got the four different kinds of drinkers, alcoholics, and each one is progressively worse. And I believe that the fellowship itself can be a solution to some people who show up in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's a good thing. But I think if you've gone down the scale as far as some of us had, you'll find that a fellowship experience by itself is going to be insufficient. And hence, you know, the big book workshop that we're having today. Now, there's some controversy rolling around the different conferences and different speakers in Alcoholics Anonymous today. And many of them see the big book movement as radical, as newfangled, and as kind of a threat to the unity of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've heard this from multiple fronts. I want to talk about where, personally, you know, this big book thing came from me. And I want to liken it to something, just to give us some perspective. I've been kind of a historian of religion, a scholar of religion for a long time. And I've done much biblical study, especially New Testament study. And one of the things that I found out was, I think we all know the experience of being a born-again Christian, the experience of believing the Bible is the inerrant word of God, that if it's in the Bible, it's true. We all know people who believe this, and there's areas of the country where they're basically in the majority. You know, the born-again brand of Christianity. Now, what a lot of people don't know is that did not exist until about the 16th century. Up until that point in time, people used the Bible in a historical, metaphorical sense. In other words, they believed that there was some history in the Bible, and they believed that there was some of the stories in the Bible were meant to be understood metaphorically. Like, these were stories that were designed to be read in congregations, that would tell a lesson in how to live a moral and spiritual life. And then around the 16th century or so, I'm never good with numbers, a man named Tyndale came along, and he came up with the idea that if it's in the Bible, it's true. If it says this, this is exactly what it says. This is exactly what happened. And he's basically the guy that started pushing out the idea that the Bible was inerrant, and it was the Word of God, and it was to be understood literally. So we went 16 and a half centuries without believing that, believing that it was metaphorical, and now there's a huge section of people who believe it's literal. Now, why I tell this story is because when the book Alcoholics Anonymous was written, there were some things in it that said things like, these are the steps we took. Well, how could those have been the steps we took? You just wrote them. You know what I mean? Now, we need to understand this a little bit metaphorically. What Bill was talking about, what he changed the steps and he numbered them. There was a reason he did that. The number 12 is a very spiritual, practically religious number. The things in the steps were things that they were doing back in the Asher group, and they were certainly things that they were doing in the early AA groups. But a lot of the things in the big book that Bill talked about that they were doing, they really hadn't done yet. He was very prophetic. And he understood what was going to happen better. He was prophetic. He understood what was going to happen better than we can imagine. There's some promises in the big book that hadn't even happened to anybody yet. There are valid experiential promises that happen to us when we experience the work in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, looking back at some of the history, I studied some of the history of AA long enough to know that I wasn't interested in studying it anymore. That happened to me about 15 years ago. I kind of stopped studying it and went on to other things. But what I believe is that I don't see that the book Alcoholics Anonymous was used in a very literal way for a long time. I think they used some of the principles and some of the exercises, certainly, but they didn't open up the big book and go through it page by page, sentence by sentence, and take every single instruction the way we sometimes do today. Where the big book movement came from that I understand today, the recovery masters that I have studied, came out of a group in Canada called the Golden Slippers. Has anybody in here ever heard of those guys? Some people have. The Denver Young People's Group is probably the genesis of the modern big book movement that I'm a part of. Now, there may be other genesises and other experiences, but the people I have listened to and basically studied under came out of the Denver Young People's Group. And what happened was this. There was a group in Canada who could not stay sober. And these guys, you know, listen, just because somebody drinks, we used to think that somebody got drunk because they didn't really want it, or they weren't really trying. I know that is not the truth. Some of us are absolutely desperate to stay sober and can't. Now, these group of people in Canada were of that mold. They were real alcoholics, like the book talks about. They were low bottom, tragically pathetic type of alcoholics that had lost most of the things valuable in their life and continued to drink, but continued to go to Alcoholics Anonymous hoping for some miracle, you know. But just going to meetings for them was not sufficient for sobriety. So what happened? One of them came up with a really wacky idea. He said, you know what? There's this book called Alcoholics Anonymous, and it says on the cover that it's the basic text of the fellowship. Why don't we all meet and open this book and read it from the very first page on? And if it says to do something, let's do it. There was a group, I don't remember it, because I'm terrible with numbers, I'm numerically dyslexic. There was 20 or 30 of these guys who did this. They made a deal. They made a pact with each other that they would start to meet together and go through these pages and do the things that the book asked them to do. And the people who made it through that, like 90% of them stayed sober for good and for all. And that got their attention. Because again, they'd been going to meetings and trying not to drink for a long time. All of a sudden, they actually do the third step prayer. They actually do a fourth step. They actually do a fifth step. They actually put an 8-step list together. They actually go out and make amends. They actually start to pray and meditate. And they actually start to take other people through this work. And what catches their attention is they stay sober. Now let's go to one of the Denver conventions in somewhere in the mid to early 80s. Don Pritz is there. A number of our heroes, a number of the people that come from my spiritual lineage were there. And Max Jeter, one of the Golden Slippers, comes down from Canada to speak. Now, instead of telling his drunkalogue, as was many of people's wants back in those days, he starts talking about his experience with this group and getting together and opening up the Big Book and doing the Big Book. Now, he gets some attention from some hardcore dudes in the Denver Young People's Group, like Don Pritz. I think Gary Brown was there, Big Frank. There's a number of them. I don't really know who all was there. But these guys then decide to do the same thing. And they get a group of people together and they open up the book Alcoholics Anonymous and they start to go through it like it's true. Like the born-again Christians of today will go through the Bible like it's true. They start to go through the book Alcoholics Anonymous like it actually is a textbook and it's not some metaphorical, historical document from the past. They start to go through it. And they have the same type of experience. And some of these guys are still alive, and some of these guys are the best people that you can listen to today because they speak from recovery experience. Now, what happens after these guys get sober in the Denver Young People's Group, there's a number of guys that are younger who get exposed to these people as sponsors, Mark Houston, Joe Hawk, a number of other people that I've found very influential in my own recovery. And they get it secondhand from these old-timers at the Denver Young People's Group. Now, this is where I first heard the message. I first heard the message, the very clear, very concise recovery message from these second-generation speakers. And I'll tell you what my personal experience was. I drank a lot of alcohol, okay? When I started to drink, I was going to get the job done. If it was your experience to sip some wine and have some beer and maybe go home and watch TV or something, my hat is off to you. When I started drinking, within 2 hours I was in a blackout. Within 3.5 hours I was passed out wherever I was, unconscious, alcohol poisoned, out cold. You couldn't wake me up. If an ambulance saw me, they'd pump my stomach and tell me that I had died, kind of drunk, every single time I drank, every single night. So if you drink like that, some bad things end up happening to you. When you drive, it's really a bad experience. When you travel, it's a really bad experience. When you try to date women, it's a really bad experience. They just hate it when you pass out on them at 8 o'clock at night on the date. You know what I mean? I mean, I was relegated to a room in my mother's house because that's the only safe place I could drink. Because I could pass out on the floor, wake up, crawl into bed about 1 in the morning, shake it off, come to the next morning, try to struggle to work, and it wasn't a big to-do. You know, I had zero social life. I had zero quality of life. I was drinking for that oblivion, that sense of peace and comfort that came at once after 13 bourbons. You know what I'm talking about? Now, I get sober because I started to get violent. Listen, I'd lost my driver's license 3 times. I'd crashed 13 cars in totals. I didn't have a friend in the world left. I was damn near unemployable. I was 125 pounds soaking wet with yellow eyes because my liver was going into failure, and none of that crap bothered me. I always thought that people that showed up in rehab because of things like that, that was pathetic. How do you let cops like force you to get sober? What got me sober was I started to get increasingly violent. I started to try to kill people and threaten to kill people. And that really got my attention for two reasons. One of them was I usually was fond of the people I was going to kill. And the other was I really didn't want to be in a cell the rest of my life, you know, with like some big, huge, you know, bank robber, you know what I mean, wearing some pink dress and doing a dance. That was not something that was on my list of to-dos. So this got my attention. The insanity got my attention. Listen, a normal person, you know that book that I think Robert Louis Stevenson wrote called Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde? Do you know that Robert Louis Stevenson was an alcoholic? Read the book. Next time you read that book or look at the movie, think about that. Because that's what I was. I was Dr. Jekyll during the day. I was a bad electrician who tried to keep out of trouble, and you know, just like really filled with self-centered fear and really bad self-esteem. You give me a quart of bourbon and I'm Mr. Hyde, and I'm a psychopath carrying around a .38 handgun. You know, it was that different. It was, and there was a level of insanity that was terrifying to me because I didn't want to be this. I was scared to be this, but I was so obsessed with alcohol, so driven to alcohol for that escape that I so needed, because the burden of living within my own mind was so great that I was driven to it night after night after night. Now, through some different experiences, I signed myself into a 28-day rehab because I knew I couldn't stay a day away from booze. I was so critically, toxically alcoholic that to stay away from booze for a 24-hour period of time would throw me into delirium tremens and raise my pulse to a very unsafe level, throw me into hallucinations, and you know, the pink elephants and the maggots and all that stuff. So I really couldn't go through, you know, sober periods of time very well. So I signed myself into a rehab, and I remember just showing up there, and you know, this old counselor, he was a grizzly old AA, you know, this guy Charlie. And I go, Charlie, you know, I'm shattered. I mean, that's the only word I could describe. I'm shattered because that morning, you know, I was shaking myself to pieces, and I knew that I wasn't going to drink that day. I was signing myself into rehab. And he immediately, that's back when counselors, untrained counselors, could write you a prescription. This guy wrote me a prescription for Librium, and they started to double me down on this stuff. And they got, I was on Librium for about 10 days during the detox, and I, you know, I started to experience treatment. That was a lot of fun. I remember the Father Martin movies. Oh my God, you know, Father Martin movies. Oh my God, if there's somebody on this planet that has no idea what I am like or what my experience it is, it's a nun in a, it's a priest in a movie, for God's sake. And I thought, you know, I had such contempt for that crap. And then they had this movie about cocaine where, you know, your head explodes. None of this stuff, you know, you cannot scare somebody that was pulling handguns on their family 24 hours ago. You know what I mean? It's just, and they had group. Anybody in here ever been in group? You know, where you sit in a big circle and you talk about the day. Chris, what are you feeling today? I want to kill you! That's what I'm feeling. So I did this treatment, and I had one half an hour meeting with a counselor in 28 days. That should be malpractice. You know what I mean? I mean, they threw me into the population and just left me in there to, well, I started to organize everybody. That's what I did. Started to organize, you know, we want better coffee, you know. I mean, you know, really, I tried to unionize all the inmates. Oh, God. Anyway, but I guarantee I was the person most serious about not wanting to drink. I mean, I wanted to stay away from alcohol the rest of my life. I get out of treatment, and they said, you might want to go to AA, but you should really go to outpatient. So I'm going to two outpatient meetings a week, paying $85 a session. And guess what we did in the outpatient? That was fun. Listen, it's some boneheaded truck driver hogged the whole 2 hours talking about the pathetic nature of his life and why it's filled with tragedy and misunderstanding. I couldn't wait for him to drink. You know what I mean? Just one moron after another I had to listen to. But I was doing it because I was told to, you know, and I was even paying money for the privilege of being completely disgusted. That's how much I didn't want to drink. And I went to two AA meetings. They weren't a home group. They were just at the top of my street. And so I really, you know, I had no idea what was what. I thought I was doing what you were supposed to be doing. The people who were staying sober in aftercare doing what I was doing. You know, I was going to two AA meetings, two outpatient meetings. What more do you guys want? You know, I mean, I'm here. I was willing. But I didn't understand alcoholism. I didn't understand that the meetings were filled with heavy drinkers who all they had to do was decide not to drink and everything was going to be fine. You know what I mean? They could take a coffee commitment and feel part of, and everything was fine. You know, I was so in my head, I was so filled with resentment and self-centered fear. You know, I'd walk into a meeting and I'd just be thinking, oh God, I'm in a meeting, there's somebody, she's not going to share again, is she? Oh no, she's going to raise her hand, no, oh, she raised her, oh God, I'm going to hear all about her family again, oh, tell somebody who cares, lady, please, oh. I mean, this is what's going through my head while I'm sitting in the meetings. And, you know, I think, oh, God, I got to go to the bathroom. Oh, if I go to the bathroom and get up and walk across the room, everybody will look at me. And they'll think, where's he going? You know, I'll look small. I mean, all this stuff is going, I'm nuts, okay? But I think going to the meetings and going to the outpatient is the treatment for alcoholism, you know? And nobody came up to me and explained the difference between the hard drinker and the alcoholic. I don't think they knew. You know, no one came up to me and said, Chris, you're not treating your alcoholism. All you're doing is showing up at the waiting room, you know? That's all you're doing. And nobody told me that. I didn't know. So one day, on the way to an AA meeting, the thought crossed my mind that I probably wasn't doing this AA stuff all that well. You know, I'm not, I don't feel like I'm giving it 100%. People are saying, you know, you got to give it 100%. I know, if I buy a gallon of vodka and I drink it, I'll be able to come back and really do this AA stuff right. So I buy a gallon of vodka to improve my sobriety. Can I tell you it went wrong? Does that surprise anybody? Now, looking back on it, because you usually know things in hindsight, you're usually a clueless moron before that, I recognize the fact that I was suffering from an obsession of the mind. In the first step, it says we admitted we were alcoholic, you know. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol. Being powerless over alcohol means lacking the power to choose when you're going to drink it and lacking the power to control it once you're drinking. So you really only got those two problems, when you're not drinking or when you're drinking. If it wasn't for those two problems, everything would be good. So I experienced a suddenly, In the book Alcoholics Anonymous, it says, suddenly the thought crossed my mind that some whiskey and some milk wouldn't hurt me on a full stomach, so here's how. Well, I experienced the suddenly. I know what they feel like. Suddenly the thought crossed my mind that if I buy a gallon of vodka and drink it, it'll improve my sobriety. So I did it on the way to an AA meeting. Now, three glasses into this vodka, all of a sudden I realized the enormity of my mistake. Because I started to get drunk, and I opened the cage door to the beast, and the beast is going to fling open the cage doors and ram his hand up my ass and move me around like a puppet for who knows how many months, because I'm not going to have any control over that. I'm just going to be puppeting like this. So that's what happened. And 7 months, I drank almost continuously. It was really ugly. It was really ugly. The obsession of the mind doesn't care if you're going to meetings. The obsession of the mind doesn't care if you've got a coffee commitment. The obsession of the mind doesn't care if you're on the grapevine committee or you're the cookie boy. The obsession of the mind is one powerful some bitch if you're an alcoholic. And it is aggressive in its nature. And to fight something so aggressive as an obsession of the mind, you need an aggressive recovery process. And watching Father Martin movies and going to the closed-minded discussion meeting at the top of my street was not aggressive enough. So, after 7 months of absolute hell, it all culminated in a terrible scene at my house. Everybody split. And I come to, after being in a drunken blackout for days, and the pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization was so thick you could cut it. Terror, frustration, bewilderment, despair. That was the good part of what I was experiencing. I was seeing demons and flopping like a fish. It was not good. I didn't sleep for about 5 days during this detox, and at the end of 5 days, I thought I had my wits about me enough to get to a meeting. And I did. I got in my car and I drove to a meeting just ringing and shattered with, you know, this detox. Now, I knew that I was going to die, and, you know, death didn't really scare me, but killing people I love did scare me. And it became very apparent that in my last blackout I had threatened my family with a gun. And it was just by the grace of God that I didn't shoot them all because they said something to me. You know how we are. And that terrified me more than anything. You know, death is almost welcome to alcoholics at different points in our time. We're not afraid of death. I mean, when the doctor said, you know, if you don't quit drinking, you'll be dead in 5 years, you usually walk out of there going, I got 5 years! You know, you're not like, I'm going to die. You're thinking, man, 5 years! Party! I mean, we're not scared. But when you can tragically alter the people's lives about you that you're actually quite fond of, That certainly got my attention. Now, I go back to meetings with a vengeance now. I know somehow deep inside that I didn't put enough into what I was doing for it to work. It would have worked if I did. So instead of going to 2 meetings a week, I'm now going to anywhere from 7 to 14. You know, I mean, I'm, you know, Saturdays I'm going to 3 meetings. And I'm plugging in as much as the self-centered fear will allow me. I'm doing as much as the self-centered fear will allow me. Like for a while, I was rendered mute in AA. I had to go to meetings where they would call on you to learn to share because I could not raise my hand. That was too much for me to bear. But I was going to a bunch of meetings, and I got a sponsor. It says, get a sponsor. I got a sponsor. My sponsor had a service ethic, so he was asking me to do things like be a coffee maker, help out at the treatment center picnic, you know, drive the boobies from the hatch to the meeting, and you know, go out to the diner afterward. And I started doing all of this fellowship stuff. Now, nobody ever came up to me and said, "Chris, none of that is treatment for alcoholism. That's participation in the recovery fellowship. That's some service. But that's not the treatment for alcoholism." Nobody said that to me. Well, this guy Radio Shack Mike one day came up and gave me a set of tapes. He was my first friend in AA. He was just nuts enough to hang out with me. How we first met was he came up to me, and how we first became friends, he came up to me and he was really freaked out. And I said something like, "What's going on?" And he said, "Oh, there was a big fight at my house. I live with three other guys, and one of them beat the crap out of the other, and I'm really scared to go home." You know, I go, "Would it help if I go with you?" And he goes, "Yeah, would you do that?" And I go, "Yeah, we're just going to stop at my house first on the way home." So we stop at my house, and I got this big Bowie knife about this long, and I strap it to my belt buckle, and I come back out to the car, and I said, "Okay, let's go." And that's how we made friends. I mean, you know, looking at me today, you would think that that's not something I'd be capable of, but I certainly was then. I was hoping this guy would give my new friend trouble, you know. Anyway, so he was one of these guys who would go to the New Age bookstores, and he was very pious. What that means is, you know, whatever he's reading that week, that's the thing, that's the key to existence, you know. "I'm reading this book on crystal therapy, you know, we got to go out and get you crystals, you need the blue ones, you know." And you know, the next week it'd be the Kabbalah, we got to do Kabbalah stuff. I mean, just from one thing to another, he would just run through the New Age bookstores like a drowning man seizing a life preserver. And this one day, he hands me a set of tapes, 8 90-minute tapes. And they're a Big Book workshop. And they were Joe and Charlie. I put them in, and I listened to them because I got kind of a long ride to work, and I told them I would. And they immediately gave me a resentment because they were a very, very strong Big Book message. These guys were classic. They were part and parcel of the early renaissance of getting us back to paying attention to the recovery side of the triangle. They were very instrumental. And I listened to these tapes and they pissed me off. But the truth in them haunted me. They spoke with authority and they used our basic text to bolster up any arguments or any positions or any philosophy they had. They could show in the book where it would say anything they talked about. So that kind of haunted me. Like the reason it haunted me was I was not hearing that at meetings. In the late 80s, in my area, there were sharing meetings, okay? Go and dump. And if you dump all your problems at the meeting, you'll leave half as light, or whatever they would share. So some of the meetings I was going to were quite toxic if you were in real trouble. If you were a heavy drinker, they were home sweet home. But for somebody who was in real trouble, they were like trying to stop a semi with a cobweb. Now, so I start listening to these Joe and Charlie things again, and I start to buy into the theory that if you pay attention to the book Alcoholics Anonymous and do the things that are in it, you will have a transformational recovery experience that will offer you a new freedom, a new happiness, a new perception, will begin to eliminate that self-centered fear, that resentment, that inability to make good decisions. The defective relationships will start to fall in place. All these things were basic promises. And out of no sense of virtue, I started to do this. Personally, I started to go through the book. Because trust me, there was nobody talking about this in the meetings I was going to. I couldn't go to somebody and say, "Could you take me through the book?" They'd pull out a 12 and 12 and say, "Read the first step over and over 100 times each day for 12 weeks and don't call me." I mean, you know, that's about what you would get. So I started going through the big book, and I started to try as best I could to do the examples in the big book. This is somewhere around 91, 92 maybe. I don't really remember. Anyway, what happened was I started to participate in a process that would allow God to heal my spirit, to allow enough of me to get out of my way for my spirit to be healed. Now, I quickly, because I started to love these Joe and Charlie tapes, I quickly started to go through the catalogs of Big Book workshops, and I got a hold of a bunch of them. David Aronofsky from Texas. I had got the Sandy Beach one. I got the Bob Bazant's 12 Steps to Success. You know, I I'm looking in this catalog, and I see Joe Hawk, Salvation Army Big Book Study. And I say to myself, I wonder what an Indian could teach me about the steps. Now, when I told this to Joe, he laughed. But I thought, Hawk, that has to be, you know, an Indian name. So I send off for these Salvation Army tapes, and they blow me away. Never had I heard the recovery mechanics put in such detail. He was meticulous in his instruction. You've got to understand, he was giving instruction to people in a Salvation Army. Has anybody ever had a Salvation Army commitment? I have. You're talking to the living dead at a Salvation Army meeting, okay? They're there to get off the streets, get a cup of coffee, and try to find somebody to rob. You know? So to try to instruct them on the big book, you had to be pretty specific, pretty sophomoric, pretty clear. So that's what these tapes were about. And they blew my mind. They started me on a recovery trajectory that I'm still on. Now that's my personal experience with Big Book Recovery. Now I really don't want it to sound like I'm critical of meetings or critical of sharing or anything like that. I know it sounds that way, but I want you to believe that I think that every meeting out there should be out there. I think that every sponsorship style is appropriate for certain people. I definitely, though, believe that if you're in real trouble with alcoholism and you've grown chronic and advanced with your case of alcoholism, your best hope is a recovery experience similar to the one that they talk about in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. When Bill was describing this in the book, he was describing some of the tactics that they used with very low-bottom alcoholics. In the first 5 years or so, they were going after people that were in straitjackets. I mean, they were going after the real hardcore, low-bottom, lost everything, pathetic, you know, pants-pissing alcoholics. And that's who they were working with. So a lot of times, the instructions in the book are about powerful enough and transformative enough to help those that are really, really sick. That's why when the majority of AA members read the book Alcoholics Anonymous, they see it as a historical document that was an overreaction to something that they've learned a lot more about today, because we go to meetings and we share. And that's their truth. That's what they see, and that's what they experience. Again, I want to make very, very clear that there's a scale of alcoholism and this big book movement that is afoot. I don't really think that we're about hurting the unity of AA. I don't think we're about making the old timers that wouldn't know a step if it bit them on the ass look bad. That's not what this is about, although many of them think that. What this is about is finding the people who are critical, who are chronic, and offering them the set of tools that's going to be sufficient for their recovery. Because we lose too many people today. We lose too many people today. I was dabbling in the professional treatment community. Marcia's actually been to some of the convention, some of the conferences and stuff that I was a board member of of this organization that would put these conferences on. And I did some web broadcasts for a while where I interviewed treatment professionals. And I got to tell you, I played in a deep sandbox with some of these guys. I mean, I've met the shining examples out there of addiction treatment in the world today, internationally. I've met many of them. And some of them get it. Some of them understand that there's a scale in alcoholism. And some of them are even honest enough to admit that there are a group of people who, like Dr. Silkworth says in the doctor's opinion, are hopeless. They're not people that professional treatment can help. They're of the hopeless variety. And some of them don't get it. Sometimes it's inconvenient for them to separate the heavy drinkers from the alcoholics because they're both paying customers and they only got the one van. You know what I mean? They only got the one counselor at 2 o'clock. So it would be inconvenient for them to mold the treatment process, one for the alcoholic and one for the disco drunk. So they don't do it. They give you the disco drunk version. And if you're a real alcoholic, you're drinking in 30 days after you get through the treatment. And they like to tell you it's your fault. It's not. It's their fault. Because they weren't honest with you. But I got in this argument just recently with a treatment professional. I made the mistake of blogging on LinkedIn professional groups, which I'm probably not going to do anymore because I don't go over well in the professional treatment community, and probably for good reason. I can be arrogant, whether you guys believe that or not. I know I come off as very humble. But I can be arrogant on some of these things. And this one guy really pissed me off. He was an addiction professional. And what he wrote was, I don't send anybody to AA or NA anymore. My God, their statistics are so bad. They're around 6%. I can get better results from a placebo. Why would I send anybody to those groups? And this guy was serious, okay? Now, I had to think long and hard about a response because it's true that our survivability rates are around 6%. If you take your census at the door, however, what is also true is rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed the path. So my instructions to what I put in my reply to this guy was, as a medical professional, if 100 people came to you for a specific operation and 95% of them sat in the waiting room but would not go in for the operation, should I hold you accountable to a 5% treatment rate? And he wrote back, no. Well, I said, you're holding us responsible for a recovery statistic for people that are sitting in the waiting room. Rarely have we seen a person fail who's thoroughly followed the path. Ask those people, did they do a fearless and thorough four-step inventory? Did they do a four-column resentment inventory? Did they share everything, holding nothing back in a fifth step? Did they put a list together of all the people and institutions they harmed? Did they go out and actually make amends to all those people and institutions that they harmed? Do they have a prayer and meditation regime that they practice consistently on a daily basis, morning, during the day, and at night? And are they working with other alcoholics, taking them through the 12 steps? Because that is thoroughly following the path. That is our operation. The waiting room is the meetings. And after rebutting him like this, I never heard from him again. I think he probably saw, you know, my particular response as inconvenient to his pet theory that AA sucks. But anyway, you know, both of those things are true. 6%, and rarely have we seen a person fail. They're both true. I don't know if I've talked on the history of the Big Book movement. Again, I always make this disclaimer. Anytime I talk about history, please understand that history is a movable science. No one can actually go back in time with a video camera and record it as it is. Many of us bring our own perceptions and our own pet theories into the study of history, and thereby skew it a little bit to the left or a little bit to the right, and I make no I make no claims as to accuracy in numbers or events or anything like that. It's basically, doesn't make it not true just because it didn't happen that way, doesn't make it not true. It's true in the fact that these things happened and were experienced in one way or another. And today we have the recovery movement, the big book thumpers, whatever you want to call them, alive and well in the English-speaking world today, and that's a good thing. Should everything be that way? No. We're only a small minority of AA members are the hardcore hopeless real alcoholics, and we should recognize the fact that there's freedom and there's traditions in Alcoholics Anonymous to allow Alcoholics Anonymous to be what it wants to be. And I think that that's right and good. And I think that as alcoholics who are recovered alcoholics, I think it's our job to go into meetings not to piss off the old timers and make them feel small, but to try to find the alcoholics who are struggling, trying to stay sober on fellowship and service alone, and single them out. You know, Scott talked about going up to somebody. Jonathan grabs people. That's what we should be doing. We should be finding the people who are in real trouble and offering them a solution and never trying to stand above any other alcoholic. You know, because we're big bookers. It does not make us better alcoholics than the oral tradition version. It doesn't. It just means that we're a little bit sicker than some of the other people. And we might need a little bit stronger medicine. Our medicine is recovery. And I want to thank Dave for coming up with this idea. Going into the future, there's going to be the traveling big book study. And we're already thinking of exotic locales to go to. Because this is so cool being in the Sahara with the howler monkeys and the botflies. We're just really enjoying the hell out of ourselves. And we have not had a bad meal. Who would have thought there was gourmet food in Costa Rica? I wouldn't have. You know, that's been my experience. And the people here, the weather, the locale, everybody's so friendly. Some great people here showed up. Some of my favorite people in the recovery community are here. And thanks a lot, Dave.